Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Imagine for a minute that instead of your usual 40-hour work week, you only work 36 hours. Maybe you're getting a half day on Friday or leaving work early every day.
Generally, I would show up between 8 and 9. I'd leave somewhere between 3:15 and 4.
That's Aaron Johansson, a lawyer at the Icelandic Transport Authority. And that dream you were dreaming, it's been real for him and his colleagues. Between 2015 and 2019, Iceland conducted a 36-hour workweek program among 2,500 workers. While Aaron wasn't part of the initial study, he's a beneficiary of the study's success. In January, his union signed a new collective bargaining agreement with the Icelandic state, reducing his hours to 36 hours a week with no deduction in pay.
My workload didn't decrease in any manner. I still had the same assignments that I needed to complete, the same deadlines, the same everything. And overall, I've delivered on all these projects. There hasn't been people who seek assistance from the authority haven't experienced, to my knowledge, any added wait times or added time that the government takes to handle their cases.
So what does Aaron do with his extra time?
I go to the gym more and facilitate meeting friends more, and also just some days just sitting and watching Netflix. I mean, outside, I'm happier with this change.
Just live his life, something that researchers say can have a great influence on workers' happiness. Aaron says he believes this reduction is long overdue.
Aren't we really at a place where technology has benefited us in so many ways, but we keep on in a work week that was established for other purposes in that time? Aren't we really at a place where we should utilize the modern technology and the productivity that can elude from it to maybe work less and maybe have more time for our lives?
That's Aaron Johansson, a lawyer for the Icelandic Transportation Authority. He's been working a 36-hour work week since January. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. Today, we're rethinking the working week. We'll begin with Jack Kellum, one of the co-authors of last month's report on Iceland's 36-hour work week study. Jack, welcome to On Point.
Hi, hello.
So, Jack, walk us through the top lines of what you found in this study about the way that workers, how working a few fewer hours a week improved workers' happiness and also didn't affect productivity.
Yeah, great. So, our study was based on amalgamating lots of research that took place in Iceland based on these trials that, as you've said, took place between 2015 and 2019, principally. So he's involved over 2,500 workers, which is in total over 1% of Iceland's entire working population. And they took place principally within the Icelandic national government, and the capital city's council, so Reykjavik City Council. So these were moves to reduce the working week by around 5 hours in a lot of instances. And alongside this reduction, there was no reduction in pay at the same time. So workers moved to less time, but were paid principally the same. So we pulled together this data, which was gathered both through interviews with participants, as well as quantitative measurements of their performance and their sense of well-being. And we found overall that these trials have brought about a significant increase in the well-being, a work-life balance of trial participants who'd moved to shorter working hours. But I think really interestingly, we also saw that across the range of different workplaces that were involved, which was from not only office work and administrative work, but also parts of hospitals and schools and so on, we found that their productivity and service provision had either stayed the same or improved over that course of time.
So what was most surprising to you about the results of this study?
So We know from a growing body of social scientific evidence the benefits that shorter working hours can bring to workers in terms of our well-being and work-life balance. We've seen that from trials that have been taking place around the world, from Japan to New Zealand and so on. I think two of the main interesting, unique lessons from Iceland's trials, on the one hand, are how even relatively small reductions in working hours, say 3 to 5 hours, like many of these workers had, I think this has shown quite how powerful these can be. And workers often said they were surprised themselves by quite how transformative they'd found this reduction in working time. But beyond that, I think it also shows quite how real a possibility shorter working hours are for a range of different sectors and workplaces. So not just the standard administrative office work, which people often assume would be the prime port of call for shorter working hours, but also things, as I've mentioned, like forms of social care, childcare, police stations were involved and so on. So I think those are the two maybe surprising or unique aspects of the study.
And you were talking about childcare. Did you look at the circumstances of different workers, for example, how it did affect parents who have at-home responsibilities?
Yes, definitely. So I think one of the common experiences and stories that comes out of the wealth of interviews and qualitative data which was gathered as part of these trials is the impact it had on those with caring responsibilities at home. So whether that was parents of children or people caring for elders and beyond and so on. I think many of these people found that that small reduction in working time just made their days on the one hand, a lot easier to organize and arrange and get between work and their responsibilities. But also, for instance, for parents of children, it chances to spend quality time with them, whether that was before work, dropping them off at school, or seeing them once they'd finished and being able to spend time in the evening with them. And what's really interesting, I think, is the knock-on effects this had for people even beyond those who were directly involved in the in the trial of shorter working hours. So, for instance, in quite a few of these interviews, people say how, you know, actually it had led to grandparents being able to spend more time with children because it had facilitated the chance for them to be dropped off, for instance, or to spend time in between them too. So you saw this radiating effect of shorter working hours beyond just the immediate participants.
So we will talk a little bit later about how this study might translate in the United States and what we can learn here about the way we work. But I first want to talk about Iceland. I've been to Iceland. It's a different work culture. I mean, among the many things that the folks there bragged about is the fact that in restaurants, for example, you don't really need to tip massively the way you do in the United States because workers make a living wage and they don't need to exist on that. Is there something about that culture that affected this study that may or may not translate generally to other countries?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think one of the driving factors behind the push to trial shorter working weeks and then embed them in the economy as has happened since was a sense of despite the fact that workers were paid reasonably well, and that Iceland is a comparatively wealthy economy in global circumstances, nevertheless, compared to many of its Nordic and Scandinavian neighbours, workers there did nevertheless work really quite long hours. And you can see that in the established OECD data around Iceland, certainly compared to its neighbouring countries, Sweden, Norway, and so on. So I think even though there's a established culture of people being paid well, there was nevertheless quite comparatively a high sense of poor work-life balance, but also quite long working hours at the same time too.
Okay. These changes are largely being driven by individual companies. Is that a way that you think this could be effective, or do you think that it needs to be a broader push, that the public sector would have to take a role in sort of pushing for or even mandating a reduction of work hours to really see these benefits play out in a more broad way?
So yeah, I think you're correct there. So in the first place, in Iceland, although it took place across a range of different workplaces, it was driven forward by public sector workers. So people working for the national government there, or people working for the city council. And I think that led a unity in the sense of purpose to the trial, which was really behind its success. However, as you've said, beyond Iceland, in places like the US, but also in the UK and beyond, often shorter weeks are being pushed forward by, as you've said, individual forward-thinking companies, potentially, who are looking to reduce their employees' shorter working hours. Nevertheless, I think the public sector around the world could be a really powerful way to pioneer shorter working hours within national economies. So, I mean, on the one hand, we know certainly in the UK, where we're based, for instance, that public sector workers are some of the people who are really suffering the effects of an overwork burnout culture as much as anyone else. So people working in schools and hospitals and so on. So they're the people in need of shorter working hours as much as anywhere else. But beyond that, I think the scale of public sector employers in lots of economies offers a chance to really redefine the national economic landscape if they were the places to push towards a reduction in working time.
So this study happened, or the person that we heard from at the beginning of this hour, the changes in his workplace were brought by a union, a collective bargaining agreement. What role do you think that can play? I mean, because even in countries where these changes are not being pushed by the public sector, there could be unions that can try to push that as well. Do you see that as an option?
I think that's certainly the case. I think that's going to be one of the avenues to push forward shorter working time. So, yeah, as you've mentioned, the unions in Iceland played a pivotal role in pushing forward for these trials and then renegotiating contracts, which have led to reduction in working hours and the experiences we heard at the top of the programme. I think, look, unions previously, in the throughout the 20th century, had a reduction in working time as one of their core demands, certainly in the early part of the 20th century. Yeah, I think we're coming towards a time where, given the effects of things like automation and so on, we need to see a redistribution of working time in favour of workers. And that might well be a demand that unions start to take up.
Okay, well, we'll hold right there. We're discussing Iceland's 36-hour workweek study and rethinking the workweek. Listeners, let us know what you're thinking. What would you do with the extra time if you worked 36 hours a week? How would you choose to spread out those 36 hours? Maybe give yourself a three-day weekend every week? We're at On Point Radio on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about the recent report on Iceland's 36-hour workweek study that piloted reduced work hours for 2,500 government employees and found that shortening work hours without deducting pay increased workers' happiness without compromising their productivity. And we're talking to Jack Callum, one of the co-authors of that report. Also joining us now is Alex Pang. He's founder of Strategy and Rest and author of several books, including Shorter, Work Better, Smarter, and Less, Here's How. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Kimberly. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So we've been talking to Jack about this study and how it worked in a place like Iceland. How do you see the potential of this reducing, even just by a few hours, the work week in America? How successful do you think it could be here?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that there are actually a bunch of American companies that have been doing this for years. Software firms, financial services, other kinds of companies. Buffer, the web services company, recently implemented it, and Kickstarter is the first company to pledge to trial it in 2022 as part of a new national campaign to try to build interest in the four-day week. So it's something that, you know, it's a small movement here in the United States, but it actually has sort of deep roots and has been growing pretty quickly in the last couple of years.
So you've actually been working with companies to implement a four-day work week, which is similar, a little different, but similar to what we've been talking about. What have you learned from those efforts?
So what I've learned is that, you know, number one, that this is something that lots of companies can do, right? It's not just like creative workers and companies where you have really kind of long project times. It's also restaurants, it's garages. There's a nursing home in Virginia that moved its certified nurses assistants to sort of a 30-hour work week and saw terrific results. So, you know, the first thing is it's not just white-collar workers, it's blue-collar workers. It's really everybody. I think the other thing is that, to paraphrase William Gibson, the four-day week is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. Studies of overwork, multitasking, of time lost in meetings tell us that companies lose something like 2 or 3 hours of productive time every single day. And so if you can get a handle on those things, right, you go a long way to being able to do 5 days worth of work in 4 days. And so, you know, I think that, and so companies find that by dealing with meetings, by using technology better, by setting aside time for deep focused work, that's how they're able to make a lot of progress toward or implementing successfully a 32-hour week without cutting salaries and without sacrificing productivity or customer service.
So I want to ask you both. I'll start with Jack. What have we learned about what workers do with that extra time? Is there something specifically that is beneficial? What's making them happier and more productive at the same time with that extra time?
So, yeah, I think it's important to stress the range of different options for workers, particularly in the Icelandic study, put their extra time towards. So we've already mentioned how for lots of workers, this went towards maybe caring responsibilities or time with their friends and family. And that's a really enriching form of, you know, collective experience, which often the isolation of working long hours can lead us to overlook and neglect. But we also heard in the data from workers who'd put it towards learning new hobbies, exercising more, taking up different activities, or even often just simply using it to rest and recover. So we heard at the top of the program interview about, you know, sometimes it's just to watch Netflix. But I think ultimately we shouldn't underestimate the impact that that ability to rest, recover and recuperate has on workers' health and well-being, but also how they're then able to perform in the job that they do.
And Alex, what about you? What have you found that workers do with that time?
The top line is they do disgustingly wholesome things. I mean, I am really surprised at the number of people who say, sort of, you know, I'm spending time with family, I'm exercising more, I'm, you know, I'm cooking better food. One company founder said in answer to this question, my people care. They care for each other. They care for themselves. They care for kids. They care for parents. They do community stuff. They volunteer. And I think that this is I'm seeing this consistently, whether you're talking about workers in the US or the UK or Japan or Australia. People, it turns out, when they have more free time, use it in surprisingly good ways, you know, to make their own lives and their family and their kids' lives better.
So we asked labor historian Emily Tuareg at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign about whether she anticipates seeing a reduced work week in America.
I don't know. It's so counter to our culture. I mean, it's tricky. I mean, it's kind of, it's a discussion of great privilege, right? Because in low wage jobs, hourly worker jobs, like at McDonald's or Burger King, in fact, folks are having trouble even getting 8 hours of work. They're underemployed. So for that group of workers, an 8 hour day is kind of an ideal that they can't even obtain, right?
We'll hear more from Professor Tuareg later in the hour about how we arrived at the standard 40-hour work week. But Alex, let me throw Professor Tuareg's point at you. The reduced work week concept is easier to grasp for salaried workers, but what would that change mean for shift workers who are paid hourly?
I think first of all, I have seen this happening in blue-collar companies. I've seen it in fast food restaurants. My favorite example is a nursing home in Virginia that moved certified nurses' assistants to 30-hour weeks while still paying them 40 hours. And, you know, that did cost them money, but, you know, because they had to hire more people, certified nurses' assistants can't be off the job. But what they found was that they saved so much money because they had lower recruitment fees, the turnover went way down, and they didn't have to call for temporary help at the last minute. That the program actually paid for itself, and so I think that while we often see this as something that's mainly for another perk for already advantaged people in our economy, it absolutely does not and should not be that way. And then I think as for the cultural issue, that companies start this in order to deal with existential challenges or other big problems that they're having. And what I'm seeing is that they make this change and then the culture changes. Nobody does it because they want to reinvent capitalism. They do it because they want to save their companies. And so, culture follows practice, but that means that the cultural change is actually quite powerful as a consequence.
And Jack, what did you find about the study? Did the study differentiate between people who had salary jobs that mostly involved being at a desk, between others like teachers or healthcare workers or law enforcement officials who have very different kinds of jobs?
So, the strategies for implementing shorter working hours in these different forms of workplaces and different forms of shift patterns, of course, depended on those, on the particular needs and circumstances that were involved. So, so often in each of the workplaces, there were discussions amongst staff as well as amongst managers as to how best to proceed to implement it in these different settings. But just to return to a point, I think, which is a really important one, which was just discussed on whether this is something which can exclusively be a reality for a privileged section of workers and so on. I think on the one hand, a shorter working week isn't the single solution to a low-pay economy, right? We should see a demand for reduction in working hours alongside a demand for the correct adequate pay and redistribution of labour within the labour market. But beyond that, there are ways in which by companies and, as we said earlier, the public sector moving towards shorter working hours, it opens up a real scope for creating new jobs, particularly in areas like healthcare and so on. If you move part of your workforce to shorter working hours, you might have to cover it by creating new jobs. And this can actually be a potential way of spreading necessary labor across the economy and across the workforce.
So we've heard a lot from our listeners on this topic, and one On Point listener, Ellen Leonard from South Carolina, said that as a city municipality worker, she would benefit from a shorter work week.
I would have more time to spend with my kids. I think I could very easily do my job in 35 hours a week or less. And I think my quality of life would be so much better. Currently, I sit in a cubicle that's about 8 foot by 8 foot for 40 plus hours a week. And part of that time I color.
And on the flip side of that, from Twitter, listener Kai Price writes, as a teacher, 36 hours is laughable, but year-round school with holiday breaks would be great. Kids would learn and retain so much more info, and that would alleviate some stress for parents who need daycare. So, Alex, is it it certainly isn't a one-fit-all formula, but it is part of this mentality. I mean, I think for a lot of teachers, it might be their first idea, maybe just based on how they know their job to be, that shaving hours off just won't work. I'm somebody who works very hard. I think it will be difficult for me to imagine working fewer hours. Is it about mentality, or are there little changes like the way work is distributed throughout the year for teachers, for example, that can sort of change the way we think about work here in America and beyond?
I think it's more about the little changes. I think schools are something of a challenge because, you know, you've got sort of parents who, you know, who expect kids to be in school 5 days a week, and there are all kinds of kind of systemic ramifications of changing how kids go to school, as so many of us have discovered in the last year and a half. I would point out that about a quarter of school districts in the United States actually have at least one school that is operating on a four-day week, though these are largely rural schools where, you know, attracting and keeping talented teachers is a real struggle, or there are places that have had to do it because of budget cuts. So it's less about, you know, kind of rethinking education or giving kids more time to be creative than it is a response to kind of financial issues. Homeschooling actually is another place in which we see plenty of experiments with four-day weeks. And so far, the results appear generally to be that, you know, kids who attend school for 4 days don't fall behind their peers. And they perform as, you know, as well on standardized tests, et cetera, as kids who are in 5 days. So, yeah, it does take some work, you know, sort of kind of systemic work. It does take kind of some time to rethink how you plan out lessons, how you plan your day. But I think even with, you know, with education, the 4 day week has already proven to be something that's feasible and that brings, you know, benefits for institutions and schools as well as for teachers. And it doesn't hurt kids.
So, Jack, I think some employers may worry that cutting hours for all of their workers is going to affect them negatively in the bottom line one way or another. What have you learned from your study about how this works economically?
So in terms of it affecting workers negatively, I mean, we haven't really seen many experiences of that from workers in Iceland. You know, many of them talked about initial adjustment periods where, for instance, they had to adjust their working practices to make sure that they were fulfilling the tasks that they've been doing in a longer period of time initially, and potentially cut out meetings, reduce the number of emails that were being circulated to an organization, or even perhaps reorganize the ways in which they were going to take breaks during the day and so on. But for the most part, workers then said that they quite quickly got used to these new ways of working, and the benefits we've already discussed in terms of well-being, work-life balance, then began to show in terms of their productivity and the services they were providing at work. So on the whole, we haven't seen too many negative impacts on the bottom line of workers.
And Alex, I want to throw that question to you as well. I mean, in some cases, it would require, for example, shift changes, people, employers having to schedule other people to be physically in place in jobs where that presence is required. How is it possible for those companies to recoup that on the other end?
Well, it's fundamentally a kind of a logistics and systemic issue. So I think what we're seeing is that this is something worth trying in institutions where you're seeing high levels of turnover, you're seeing high levels of burnout, and those are places where you have, you know, constant challenges with recruiting new people, with, you know, skilled, very talented people walking out the door, with people who are empathetic and, you know, creative when they first start their jobs, sort of losing that because they're sort of because they're stressed and burned out. And so, you know, even in cases where you do have to hire more people, you're seeing these sort of benefits that come from, you know, savings that come in other places that help offset the cost of these programs. And you're seeing sometimes some pretty dramatic increases in sort of quality and provision of services.
So, Alex, are there things that we learned through the pandemic when all of us almost changed the way that we work that casts further light on these studies about reducing hours?
Yes. So, you know, for one thing, there were companies that moved to 4-day weeks during the pandemic because of the changes that they had to make during lockdowns. You know, they had to sort of invest in new collaboration tools or sort of remote working platforms. And this enabled them to be sort of more productive while their workforces also were getting stressed because they had to, you know, simultaneously sort of work from home while homeschooling and so on. And so what they found was that the technology changes allowed them to be sort of more productive, and they made the choice to give back some of that time to workers as a way of making everybody's lives better. And I think what that shows us is that, you know, probably there are lots of companies who have similar kinds of stories that are now in a better position to sort of just operationally to move to sort of a shorter work week. And I think we've all seen that we're, you know, everybody is a lot more capable of reinventing how we work and doing so much more quickly than I think we ever thought possible in, you know, January of 2020. And so we have this window of opportunity as we move, you know, back to normal to change how we work and to change it for the better. And I think the 4-day week could be part of that.
All right, we're going to talk a lot more about that window opportunity on the other side of this break. We're discussing whether a new standard of a shorter work week can become a new reality. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Tomorrow, we are taking a look at the diverging realities for the vaccinated and the unvaccinated across the U.S. as the Delta variant continues to spread. We want to hear all the questions you have about navigating this stage of the pandemic. What questions do you have? What are you seeing in your community? Leave us a voicemail with your questions and stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. From 2015 to 2019, Iceland conducted a 36-hour workweek study for 2,500 government employees and found that shortening work hours without deducting pay increased workers' happiness without compromising their productivity. And we're joined by Jack Collum, one of the co-authors of that report. Also with us is Alex Pang, founder of Strategy and Rest, and where he's helped companies implement 4-day work weeks. Now, we've been talking quite a bit about reduced work weeks, but let's take a moment to understand how we arrived at our current standard. Emily Tuareg is a labor historian at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She told us at the beginning of the 19th century, people typically worked 6 days a week with the working day, and the working day was very long.
Folks were working, I'd say 10 to 12 hours a day with short breaks to do their business. But other than that, they were pretty much at the whim of their employer, and there were no regulations, state, local, or national, that said otherwise. So yeah, your day was not your own, and you didn't, you couldn't do much besides work, right? Because you were just so physically exhausted.
In the early 19th century, the country saw organized efforts to reduce the length of the working day.
1835, you have Philadelphia carpenters who were calling for a shorter work day. I mean, we have to remember, they're actually calling for a 10-hour day to start. Over time, by the height of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s, we have this national strike for the 8-hour day. And the movement was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will. You know, at this point, we're talking the height of the Industrial Revolution, and unions were beginning to gain some traction. And so you had the formation of the American Federation of Labor, who successfully organized predominantly skilled workers. So that early labor movement is able to leverage their collective power to begin to organize some contracts that allow for shorter work days.
But although the workday was getting shorter, the work week remained 6 days. The transition to a 5-day work week came over the following decades, including an early adoption by the Ford Motor Company in 1926. The first federal move to encourage this change came in 1933, when the U.S. Senate passed a bill limiting the work week to 30 hours as a means to spread the amount of work available during the Great Depression. That provision was not taken up by the House. Instead, we ended up with the 40-hour work week as part of President Roosevelt's New Deal.
In 1938, there's the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the act that kind of enshrines our understanding of the 40-hour work week, where the government is saying you have to pay overtime now, which is obviously going to discourage employers from having people work more than 40 hours a week.
That's Emily Twarig, Associate Professor of History and Labor Studies at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. And why 40 hours? Many historians pin that on 19th century Welsh industrialist Robert Owen, who led the charge for the standardized working day with the slogan, 8 hours labor, 8 hours recreation, 8 hours rest. So, Alex, it's been 83 years since FDR signed the Fair Labor Standards Act. Is it time for our standard of the work week to change again?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we have, for generations, labored in a system, labored in a work week that was really designed for, you know, for industry, for factory work. And we have taken for granted that this is how, you know, this is simply how work happens. This is the natural rhythm. And everything else is kind of built up around that, you know, school days and sort of vacation schedules and so on. But I think that we have all had the collective experience in the last year of seeing that what seem like incredibly solid sort of structures and practices are actually ones that we can break apart and we can remake. And I think we've seen that we need to do this, and that now is the time sort of to seize that moment and to think about how we want to work in the future.
And Jack, how do we convince lawmakers to do that? I mean, here in America, trying to get any law passed seems like an insurmountable task. What can we learn from what we've seen in Iceland and elsewhere that can make that case that, hey, maybe it's time to take another look at this and change federal standards?
So I think the Icelandic experience is testament to the relationship that unions have in that country with public sector employers. It was a really collaborative approach in which unions were able to push for this, for it to be trialed and then implemented and sedimented in a range of contracts across a significant proportion of a country's working population. So I think it shows, and just hearing from that clip, you know, the move that we've had in the past to reduce working hours has always been one which has been put forward and struggled for by workers themselves, alongside other enlightened managers and owners of companies and so on. So I think it's important to realize that as important as forward-thinking companies will be, ultimately turning the shorter working week and the 4-day week into one of the principal demands for unions and workers who are organizing is going to be a really important part of the struggle towards that.
And Alex, what have you seen from your work with individual companies here that can serve as an example for, you know, lawmakers, whether not at the federal level, but perhaps at the state or local level, to take a look at, to figure out what they can do, even among their own employees, to bring some of these practices to bear?
Well, I think even if we didn't, you know, have to go through the torturous process of federal legislation, you know, to make a 4-day week a national standard, there's a lot of stuff that sort of governments can do, right? They've got a lot of tools in their toolkit, and there are small issues around, you know, around things like how you classify part-time work, or sort of how you sort of deal with overtime, with other kinds of labor law issues that sort of could go a long way to helping companies that want to implement 4-day weeks sort of figure out how to do this and stay on the right side of the law. I think also it's just going to be a matter of time before you get some, you know, far-sighted sort of, you know, mayor or local official who decides, you know, as a way of improving work-life balance in our town, of bringing people, you know, and small businesses back in here, of making ourselves a destination for good quality of life and a robust economy, we're going to promote a 4-day week, and we're going to work with or of local businesses, we're going to work with the schools, with the Chamber of Commerce, with nonprofits, and sort of we're going to become the destination for companies that want to work this way and for people who want to live this way. And I think that this is, you know, in Seoul, South Korea, in the recent mayoral election, the 4-day week was one of the big subjects. And so I think it's just a matter of time before you see innovation moving from companies and from nonprofits to sort of the government sector, and I think we can look forward to seeing that sort of sooner rather than later.
So, Alex, we talked about how we learned from the pandemic how work can be done differently, how adding that flexibility is something that can be really beneficial. But there's also a flip side to that, right? I had a discussion with someone about how perhaps we're not working from home so much as we are living in our offices because we are constantly connected through our cell phones, through Zoom and other video programs. And so the work day has kind of been blurred. I mean, I, for example, actually took on more jobs during the pandemic, which is why I can have this discussion with you now as a guest host on Point. How do you square that? Isn't culture moving kind of in two separate directions right now?
Well, you know, nobody's invoked John Maynard Keynes yet in this conversation, so sort of I will. That, you know, he had sort of a saying, either him or Bertrand Russell, actually, that, you know, in the future we could have overwork for a few and starvation for many, or we could have a world in which everybody worked less. And, you know, I think that the, you know, we have unintentionally created the first, and I think we need to think through how we, you know, sort of how we get to the second. And, you know, the pandemic is not, we were all working under pretty adverse sort of adverse circumstances. And so it's not a surprise that we would kind of fall back or rely on kind of, you know, bad habits in order to get through the day and get through that period. But I think that, you know, we have also learned that there are things that we don't want to keep doing, right? And I think that one of the things that it has illustrated is that, you know, boundaries actually are good things between sort of work life and home life. That when your commute consists of moving from one side of your couch to the other side of your couch, this has conveniences, but it also raises issues that we need to, and this is not something that we should take as natural, something that we should assume we have to work with in the future. And so, yeah, I do think that there are things, you know, things that we got accustomed to during the pandemic that we have to back away from, just as there are things that we learned about work and work, you know, and sort of working conditions that we would, that it would be great to be able to build on in a more positive fashion.
What about that point, Jack? I mean, I know you studied and found the benefits of the shortened work week, but does that fully take into account the fact that, you know, we might be answering emails during off hours, or we might actually be doing more work than what is officially clocked in.
I think that's a really important point, and I'm glad it's been raised. So on the one hand, in terms of the trials that took place in Iceland, you know, well, it was a real concern, I think, going into these trials to make sure that hours actually were effectively reduced, that it wasn't just formally reduced on paper, but people working less, but that their actual working time was really cut by the amount of hours that were intended within these trials. So there were lots of... And that was at the heart of the planning process that went into these workplaces, was exploring different strategies to make sure that employees weren't merely brought into meetings just as work finished and so on, weren't expected to answer emails outside of office hours and so on. So on the one hand, it was in these Icelandic trials, it was at the forefront of their planning process. But beyond that, you do raise a really important point about the ways in which work and life have often become blurred in our contemporary economy, and the ways in which remote working can potentially accentuate that even more. I think this shows again that, you know, we have to look beyond just the single policy of a four-day week to see other ways in which you're going to have to be able to draw a clear line between our working lives and our lives beyond it. So, for instance, at Autonomy, we're interested in ideas like a right to disconnect, which could be legislated for, which, you know, in different economies and in places like France is already an established part of our landscape, in which workers aren't obligated to look at their phones, answer their emails outside of the working hours that they're contracted for, and so on. So we should see other avenues like that, such as that, as important ways to really protect any reductions in working hours which we might gain in the future.
Alex, some of our listeners are sending us messages that essentially say, look, before we can start talking about 36 hours, can we find a way to get us to stop working 60 hours or 50 hours? Is this, what about those modest changes that can maybe get us to an actual 40-hour work week? Is that a place to start?
You know, I think you sort of... Yes. I mean, I think that there are companies that are doing what they call firm 40-hour work weeks, where, you know, they're doing exactly that, right? Moving from, you know, 50 hours or more down to sort of down to a more, you know, a more reasonable sort of work week that they had, you know, that that is more in line with sort of what everybody else does. You know, you also see this in restaurants where, you know, some restaurants have moved to four-day weeks and people aren't working 32 hours. You're still, you know, you've still got long days when you're on. But there is a world of difference between working, let's say, 48 hours over 4 days and working, you know, 72 hours or so, which is where, you know, lots of these people come out of. So, you know, and then finally, I would say that big companies and governments often go about their work time reductions a little differently than, let's say, small companies. Small companies can kind of do a sort of lightning round of planning and then just jump in and sort of, you know, kind of fail fast, figure out how to make it work and kind of right the ship and sort of they're off and running. Larger organizations tend to take more time. They do it a little bit more gradually. And you might do it, you know, let's say geographically. So Medtronic, for example, which is a medical instrument and pacemaker company, they have different offices in Asia that have been experimenting with shorter work weeks. And the hope is that eventually what they've learned in the Tokyo office and the Seoul office in Singapore, you know, can be transferred to other parts of the company. Or, you know, I think Iceland is a great example of a place that actually did an awful lot of forward planning. They spent months thinking through all the different contingencies, figuring out how to make this part of the plan work and that part of the plan work. And I think that was an important component in sort of, you know, in successfully providing public services, even in sort of the context of a shorter work week. So I think that there are a lot of different ways that they can do it. Yeah.
Well, I just want to ask Jack quickly, why stop at 36? Might 32 be next? Just a couple seconds.
I think that's a really good point to raise. And we heard earlier on how this reduction in working hours was once seen as a utopian demand by people like Robert Owen, but, you know, it became a reality. So we can afford to dream big, I think.
All right. Jack Callum is a researcher at UK-based think tank Autonomy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Alex Payne is founder of Strategy and Rest and author of several books on working less. Alex, thank you.
Oh, thanks. It's been a pleasure, Kimberly.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.